Get ready to expand your horizons and discover great reads. This is Bookbound, a library podcast.
Welcome back to Bookbound. I'm Jessica Trotter. I'm joined to the mic by Cheryl Lindemann and Maricela Garza. Hey, ladies.
Hello.
We are coming down to the end of summer. I don't quite know how we got here.
Yes, it's actually the end of summer reading tomorrow.
Yeah.
Summer
reading. So that's when we're, yep.
Challenge at the library.
I have six more activities to do. Can I do it? I want to visit a museum. I want to get a metro or a map pass.
Yeah, well, all within a day? No.
Yeah, you got a lot to do tonight and tomorrow. You have tomorrow.
I have to finish my bookmark.
It's Ingham County Fair, I believe.
Yep. It's fair time.
To me, it was the fastest, most fleeting summer ever. I don't know.
It went fast.
Yeah. Very, very, very fast.
So, but we have a bunch of books.
Yep.
And a wide variety of books. Oh, yeah. Actually, I think we want to talk about something else, too.
We do.
First.
And while the summer sadness for me is winding down, it's sort of tempered by my excitement about one particular event this fall. And listeners may have already heard about One Grand Read. This is our second year for this event. We have a really, really exciting author event scheduled Sunday, September 27th at 2 p.m. at the Kellogg Center. We have Hanif Abdurraqib coming. And this will be just a fantastic author event and the culmination of our One Grand Read program. You can learn more at onegrandread.com. And I know we've talked about Hanif Abdurraqib's books many times on the podcast. Mm-hmm. And we have talked about this book, which is There's Always This Year on Basketball and Ascension. I'm actually listening to it. I read it a number of years ago when it came out. And it's just such a great experience to listen to it. And I believe you both have listened to it, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And our producer has too, I believe. Yeah, so, yeah.
It's just great. I mean, it's read by him. It's poetry. It's just, he's just a great writer. And it's just a great book. I mean, it's kind of for anybody. I mean, it's nominally about basketball, but it's also not about basketball at all. It's about community. Yeah. It's about achievement. There's so much in it.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So we're all looking really, really looking forward to this program. We do encourage listeners to check out the site, get more information. There are a lot of side programs at our partner locations, including ourselves. So there's quite a lot to do with this book, and just something to get really excited about. And I'm just really excited for our listeners who haven't read, or people who participate in this program who haven't read him yet, to pick him up and read him. Because it's, I would say he's just an absolutely 100% unique writer. I mean, in that it's that blend of the poetry, of the cultural and music critic that he is, of you know, prose, everything just kind of comes together into this, of analysis, into this really extremely unique way of writing that only he has. So,
agree.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is Mari, and I'm going to get rolling with our titles for this month. The first book I have is a young adult title or a teen title called Holloway by Alana K. Arnold. Let me try to set this up without giving too much away, but it is summer 2021. The pandemic is sort of beginning to look like it's in the rear view mirror, but not really. And we have an 18-year-old. Her name is Nora. And we learn from really basically right away that she is on the autism spectrum. And she has really a lot of loss. In fact, no more family. Her mother is gone, her grandmother long gone, many, many decades, well, at least a decade and a half ago, I guess you could say. And she has decided to pack up her apartment in California. She's either given things away or sold them, and the book kind of starts out with her on the train in Paris, and you learn kind of with flashbacks, like why she's there. She has a cylinder with her full of ashes. And you learn that her mother has been one of the persons who was taken as a result of COVID-19. And her mother always wanted to go to Paris, always wanted to be there, because both Nora and her mother, Jillian, have this affinity for art, and specifically impressionistic art, I think. And they have always wanted to go to some of the scenes in the art that they used to hang in their home or their apartment, and just really dreamed about doing it. So Nora has decided to go to Paris and find this one scene. She's all alone. But what you learn really kind of, you know, in these pages as she's leading up to getting to this place is that she's really, in some ways, just kind of numb from the experience of having her mom and maybe others in society view her as this, like, semi-broken or broken person because she's neurodivergent. Just constantly having to change herself, mm-hmm. in order to fit in order to not have the stress that is really, you know, her mother feels as a result of who she is. And so there's a lot of, you know, mentions of, like, you know, having to mask and having to do things that will accommodate others. And one of the things that I especially noted, I was really struck by this, because she writes that, "I've never liked school conceptually. It's always struck me as strange, the idea that just because a person is a minor, they have to submit their body and mind 5 days a week from 8 o'clock in the morning until 3 o'clock in the afternoon to a system that forces them to perform tasks dictated by that system." And you just learn, like, what of a slog that was. And I'm sure that this is probably the case for other children as well. I mean, I hear that a lot of children are very social and they really like going to school, but there are some definitely who don't. And, you know, they may not be neurodivergent either. It's just not something that appeals to them, this method, this societal way of bringing education to people. And you know that Nora is really, really smart. She doesn't need to be in school if she doesn't need. She can find different ways. So that was really kind of striking to me. But to get on with it, Nora gets to one of these park scenes, which, by the way, turns out to be not that nice anymore, at least not the way it looked in the painting. And she's kind of disappointed, like, oh, man, it's just like, what do I do now? You know, and the French people are noticing her. They're kind of like, you know, looking out for her, asking, "Are you okay? What's going on?" So she makes a decision to, you know, go somewhere else to drop her mother's ashes. And the next thing you know, she's in a forest, and this book has become a portal book.
Oh, okay.
Which is where, you know, Holloway, I was like, well, what does that word really even mean? It's kind of like a sunken path, really made that way because of many, you know, centuries or decades of travel with, you know, carts and foot traffic. And so it's like this natural, you know, sunken little trail, basically. And she ends up there. And the next, you know, she's in 1946. And it becomes a bit of a World War II story. I'm going to leave it at that, but I was really struck by this book because it's very introspective, very almost emotionally intimate. And I read it very, very slowly, and really, really liked it. I hope that many of our teen readers, particularly if you're interested in neurodivergent teen experiences and at least how Nora thinks, this is just really, really great book.
Very cool.
Oh, that sounds just phenomenal, like in every way. Yeah, I think it's really interesting. It touches on school burnout with neurodivergent people in particular, yeah. Which, again, like you said, school burnout is a universal experience with young people, but there's a unique, I think, flavor to burnout with neurodivergent children and teens.
Right.
Oh, really? Right. Very, very interesting.
Yeah, I'll say Alana is really a master at writing stories, I think, about children with neurodivergent tendencies. She's the author of a series called Bat, which is a kind of more of a middle grade or elementary school book. And then I was just telling Jessica earlier, like, I remember What Girls Are Made Of, which was, I think it was a National Book Award honoree, maybe, many years ago. That was really incredible.
Okay.
Really incredible.
Okay. Yep.
Wow. Sounds so good. Well, I have the next title, which is called Python's Kiss, Stories by Louise Erdrich. And Louise Erdrich is just really a masterful writer. We've talked about her on the podcast before. And a unique thing about this book is that the cover and all the illustrations within were illustrated by her daughter. And I was reading about her, and actually the backlist, when her books were republished and reprinted, all the backlist covers were illustrated by her daughter as well. And she was saying how unique that is, because so many covers are not, the control of the covers is not so much always like that for authors. So it's just a really special kind of bond with her daughter that she had through this book. And I believe I read that her other daughter narrates the audiobook. So really cool kind of family involvement here. But this is a series of stories. Some have been published before in The New Yorker and other ways, but they're all compiled here, and it's years worth of stories. And what I really loved about this collection is how incredibly playful it is. I came to Louise Erdrich, Erdrich through her historical fiction type stories. The Last Report of the Miracle at Little No Horse was my favorite, The Master Butcher's Singing Club, and some of her other ones, The Painted Drum. And there are stories in this collection that are like that. If you love that sort of historical earth, animal, indigenous culture, you know, this kind of swirling stories that she tells. Some of the ones that are like that are Love of My Days, which is actually sort of a romantic Western story, which was wonderful. But she also plays with form here in a way that some of those readers might be like, what is this? Because she does, she explores science fiction in this through two stories. My favorite was called Domain, which is a place where the character goes after death, essentially, and her memories are all sort of harvested in this sort of cloud. So that's a really unique departure from the books that I'd read by her. My favorite stories were Love of My Days, one called December 26, which is extremely poignant, and Borsalino, which is almost like there's a haunting and a ghost that is in this story. That's also very, very interesting. There are tons of animals, lots of magical realism, quite a bit of violence, really, relationships with the earth in so many ways that you can interpret that term. And I love the playfulness with form. I think that's probably the most interesting. I think a lot of times people expect an author to stay in their lane, like, this is what I think of you as. And it's really, that's not what an author, they're artists, right? They want to do what they want. And sometimes authors, I think, lose readers with that one book that people are like, this wasn't like the other books. Like Kazuo Ishiguro is one of those authors, you know, where sometimes the experimentation loses the base in some ways. But I think this one was really, really fun and lively and just full of life and passion, really for the earth at its heart. So just a great read. Great summer read, I thought.
Cool.
Yeah.
My first book is Field Guide for the Formerly Villainous by Autumn K. England. This one, I was trying to figure out how to kind of pull down kind of what this one was about. It is both surprisingly funny, but a deeply moving story about, it's fantasy. It's Oakland Nettlewood accidentally joined an evil cult. Truly, accidentally. It wasn't an evil cult when they joined. They really were just sort of, they were young. They were told that somebody would teach them how to use their magic for free. And their parents weren't having it, they had magic. And it was kind of hard not to use it, because it's just part of their body. So accidentally joined a cult, becomes possessed and controlled by an evil witch, who's hell-bent on taking control of the world. Forces of good defeat the witch, manage to not kill all the people who have been mind-controlled. And so Oakland's sort of left alive, not a whole lot of memories still, and a lot of trauma. And they sort of get a little bit of, you know, sort of a survivor's grant to get them started in their life, and they decide what little they can remember of their life before, they're gonna start a farm. They're gonna buy a farm and get it up and running and try to heal themselves that way. So the book opens with them signing on the dotted line to buy this farm, and the person who sells it to them walks away, and almost immediately the farm's ghost appears to them and says, "So, now we're going to have to get started and get you trained up to be the farmer to run this and help with the community." Now, Oakland has pretty much decided they are never going to use their magic again. And the ghost is like, "Nope, you need to be using this for good, and we're going to teach you how, and you are going to help this community because they need your magic for good, for the good." So it's a mix of how do you recover from being in a cult, where you did horrible things, not of your own free will, but you did it. There's the other side of it. In the community, you have people who fought on the other side and killed people who didn't do things on purpose, and, you know, and now living with that. But you also just have this really interesting community of characters who welcome Oakland without knowing their background, but welcome them with open arms. And then it's that question of, will they like me when they find out my backstory?
Yeah.
So, but it's just really well done. And it looks at grief. It looks at trauma. It's just a really neat community. A sort of quiet little community that is powerful on its own. It's a, you know, it's got a couple of, you know, not wonderful people, but there aren't that many. And it all is just, it's about trusting community and building community. And I really liked it.
That sounds really interesting.
It's a wonderful audiobook, too. I did both read and listen.
I like the aspect of the farm, that's mm-hmm. the choice. It's like so, like completely grounding.
Yes, I think that's absolutely.
Interesting. I mean, I don't think you see that as much in speculative fiction, farms, or is it becoming more so?
I think it falls into that sort of the cozy fantasy.
Okay.
The kind of development of the cozy family. You get more city scenes with bars and coffee shops and bakeries, but I think the farm is sort of a natural, and his friends, you know, his first friends are the people who run the pub and one of the local musicians, and then the librarian in town. So
yay.
Yep, exactly.
So, cool.
No, it was just a fun. I'm not sure what I expected, but it was just it really drew me in and kept me going.
Cool. So.
Yes.
Hey, so again, this is Maddie, and I have a picture book that I want to recommend. It is The Rare Bird by Elisha Cooper. Okay, let me just say that there's a cat on the cover. Mm-hmm. So I really don't want to give too much of this away because it is so quirky. But let's just say, so it starts out by saying, the rare bird flew through the forest. Flying so fast, he knocked over the leaves off the trees. So throughout the story, there's this cat telling you what he's doing, and he's, you know, going through the forest doing all these wonderful things. This is a story that is like giving you all these words, but the pictures that are there don't exactly match. Go with what he's
right.
what he's saying.
Right.
It is just so striking to me how like you can picture that the cat might be dreaming, the cat might be living his best life. This was a really, really very cool book. I really liked it a lot. And I'm also going to end here with just in the spread at the beginning, the cat is actually looking at books that are opened up. So there's like a little sub messaging there about, you know, wait a minute, books kind of might take you places, even though you're in, mm-hmm. you know, maybe your bathroom or your living room or wherever. Mm-hmm. It's really, really, really cool. I'm also going to give a nice shout out to River, which is also an Elisha Cooper book, picture book. Stunning. There's a canoe. There's a woman paddling through on the Hudson River. It's this is one of my favorite books by Elisha Cooper. So
all right,
sounds excellent. I think I've read River before, and I agree that was really kind of a transporting experience for a picture book. Yeah,
yeah.
I have Riding Magic by Kelly Starling Lyons, illustrated by E.B. Lewis, another picture book. And this is one of those situations where I just saw the cover, either in technical services or in somewhere out in the world of books.
It's
and
a horse.
It is a little girl with this black horse on it that looks like an Arabian horse, which it actually is. I delved into who the horse is.
Okay.
But it is just an absolutely gorgeous picture book about a little girl named Dom who goes to her uncle's horse farm, and her sister's quite the rider. And the family, her mother grew up with horses. It was like part of their experience, but she's really afraid to ride. And they're like, hey, come on. She's like, no, I'm not doing that. That looks really scary. And so her sister goes to ride, and she sort of has one of those mystical animal brief moments with a horse named Magic, who's this beautiful black glossy horse, and she just feels like this kind of kinship with him. And she's like, you know, I think I can ride Magic. I think I can do it. And that night, she has this dream, which is my favorite part of the book. It says, that night, I dream about horses. I see people who look like me riding them long ago, and they call me up to join them. Magic neighs like he's waiting for me. We take off for the clouds and gallop through the sky, clip-clop, clip-clop. And then she goes, and she's infused with this sort of dream, sort of helped her. And then she goes, and she rides him, and she imagines now, like, she feels those wings of riding and is like, okay, we can do more. I feel this, you know, this was a great bond. And one of the neatest things about this book is that it was actually, it was centered on Caitlin Gooch, who is the black cowgirl. You can see her online, that sort of thing. She did the nonprofit Saddle Up and Read. She's the founder of that. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of, I don't want to say filmed because it's illustrated, but it was based off of her farm. And Magic is based off of one of her horses, who is an Arabian horse, who is really wonderful with children. And there's a little in the acknowledgments, there's thanking the Gooch family and their farm, and thanking Caitlin Gooch, and also thanking a great children's book author, Floyd Cooper, in the acknowledgments too. So it's just a really lovely book, and about that fear that a child can have. Not just, it could, in this instance, it's for horses, for riding horses, but just to do anything, the fear about doing anything and overcoming that. But what I loved was sort of this community of black equestrians coming to her in her dreams and empowering her. And I think that was almost the most special part of it, and touching into that history of black cowboys and cowgirls throughout history. It was just really just a lovely, lovely book, but a great one for a kid who's scared to go swimming, who's scared to do anything, who's sort of like, I can't do it. And they don't force her, which I also like.
Right.
They let her sort of come to it on her own.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that title, if I'm not mistaken, is it E.B. Lewis who is the illustrator?
Yes.
It's just stunning, stunning work. And it just, I can see why it appealed to you if you saw it on a cart, because the cover and then many of the spreads, just beautiful, beautiful work.
Wonderful. And then I have another one that has a little bit, I think of horses all the time. It's never left me. I started when I was 3 and it's never left me. But to me, horses are summertime. There's something about being at the barn with the fireflies. It's different for me than being in the suburbs with the fireflies. They're out there more. There's just, to me, it's summer's that. But summer's also a little bit of swimming. And let me tell you, this has been the fastest summer of my life. I said that in the beginning. There's not been one dip into the pool, not even a toe. There's nothing. There's been no swimming. So I've been drawn to this book for a long time, finally read it. It's called At the Pond, Swimming at the Hampstead Ladies' Pond, and it's written by a number of authors, some quite famous, some that you've never maybe heard of. And it's set at the Kenwood Ladies' Bathing Pond, which is a real swimming pond, started in about 1920 in the Hampstead Heath in London. It is only for women and trans women. It is not for men at all. There is a man's pond and sort of a mixed pond, but there is no, you're not allowed to go there if you're not a woman. You're also not allowed to take photographs. It is a deep pond. There's no edge. You have to go in through a ladder. And so it's sort of a London special landmark. It's sort of a pilgrimage that people go to this. But for a long time, what it's been is really a sanctuary for women. That's what most of the essays touch on. It's a place where they absolutely can let down their guard. It's also a place for wild swimming. So you can swim there literally year round. People swim in the wintertime. It's freezing. There's lifeguards that help to keep you safe. You can only go in for a little bit because you can get so disoriented that you might stay in longer and like drown in there. So it's kind of dangerous, but wild swimming is really, really big, I feel like, in Britain. Whenever I read memoirs, it seems like even Catherine May talks about wild swimming. It's something, I know people do it in the US, but it is seems very British, possibly European, to wild swim. In the winter, going in like the Atlantic and stuff like that. It's just something they do. So two of the authors in this book I've talked about before, Nina Minyapoulos and Jessica J. Lee, and they talked about wild swimming in their books, and they have two of the essays in here. Mm-hmm. But some really more popular authors, Deborah Magok, who's a little bit older author now, Margaret Drabble, who you don't hear about as much anymore, but she's in here too, but Esther Freud. So just a really great collection. And if you can't go swimming this summer, this might be a substitute, but also has that unique historical aspect of talking about the history of this pond and this history of like a safe space where people can just be and not.
I find that really just interesting because I do feel like there's like this, if not outright, then subtle pressure to like not have segregated spaces anymore.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
particularly in the pond setting or swimming hole setting, it sounds very appealing.
Yeah, it really is
a women only place.
Yeah, and so there's also a meadow, so people go in the water and then they go on the meadow and they read and that sort of thing, and they, sometimes take off their tops. That's what they say. It's like, which may not be podcast appropriate, but in that sense, again, there's no pictures allowed because it is supposed to be a safe place. Mm-hmm. And I must say, it's very multi-generational, and they have a large number of 80-year-old women who have been doing this like their whole lives, or they're just starting. So it was a really neat read. I do encourage you to check it out. It sounds. Mm-hmm. It always interested me, and again, I learned about it through other books. Mm-hmm. And then when this compilation came together, I think it's a Daunt Books compilation, I was like, okay, I gotta read that.
So. Okay, so I'm kind of jumping off the summer portion of this, or the humid, by the water type of feel that came in this book. I just read The Tainted Cup by Robert Jackson Bennett with my book discussion group. I was so happy they picked it. It's the first full disclosure, my book group is the current science fiction fantasy. So this is a Hugo winner, but it's also an Edgar nominee, which means it was shortlisted for one of the best mysteries of its year. It is a solid mystery in a fantasy setting with a fascinating pair of sleuths. It is sort of a, I would say, island kind of Asian-esque nation that is, gave me a feel of, if anybody who's read China Mieville, sort of like Perdido Street stuff, there's a bit of body modification, and the lightest of body horror is part of this society. People change themselves to find work. So we have a very, very eccentric Holmesian type figure named Anna, who is, when you're introduced to her, she has basically grabbed, somebody has come to her door and she has invited them in under false pretenses and is now interrogating them when her partner or assistant comes in and tries to save the guy and basically says, you can't keep doing this to people.
Oh my gosh.
Her assistant has been modified so that he absolutely retains, he's called an engraver. He remembers everything. Oh. He's been modified to remember everything. So the book actually opens with him going to a crime scene. Up to this point, he's only ever been to like fraud cases, bank fraud, money fraud type things like that. And this is a murder scene. And this is his first murder scene. He's only been Anna's assistant for about 4 months. It's not a pretty death. This is a society that, because they do these kinds of different kinds of modifications, there's things happen, contagions happen, people, illnesses can spread, and the things that they use to modify themselves can sometimes not be as well controlled as they plan, and it can cause different kinds of problems. The body that is found is a plant has just kind of grown out of it and killed the person and actually grown tall enough to punch out of the building that they were in. So it's a very weird, strange, and off-putting scene that Din has never seen anything like this before. No, knows nothing about it, has never had to do this kind of inquiry, but basically goes around this whole this estate, interviews everybody, observes everything, and takes that information back to Anna and just regurgitates it back to her, and she's like, okay, we need to do this, this, and this, and this is, you know, she doesn't tell him who did it, but she can basically figure out the answers for this part of the mystery, and get it going. And it's just the first step in a larger, bigger thing that's going on in the community. And there's this whole backstory of it's this rainy season is about to happen, and during the rainy season on the walls, there are creatures that will try to climb the walls and get into the community. And my book group had a field day trying to figure out, like, why are they in the path of these things that want through? What are these things that want through? Why are they even dealing with this? So it's just, there's a lot to the world that isn't explained even fully in the first book that you just want to know. And I don't think, there are more books now. I don't think we were assured that there would be more books at the end of the first, you know, when he first published the first book. But it's now, the third book has just been released this week. And I'm really excited to keep going with the series. Anna and Din are a really neat pair. And there's more to both of them than, you know that there's more to both of them right from the beginning, but you're sort of getting more and more information. The characters were great. The mystery was really well done, and I would highly recommend them.
All right. Wow. Sounds extremely unique.
It was. It just was. Yeah. So yeah.
You did a good job explaining it, because I can imagine these walls and these creatures crawling.
And it's really, it pulls, it very interestingly, I mean, it's fantasy, but it doesn't, until you get back to sort of, it's fantasy, but it doesn't have to necessarily read as fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very good mystery, but you then get these kind of, you know, you have these modified beings, people, you have that kind of existential threat out there. Because it sort of feels away for a lot of it until, you know, you're actually anywhere near the wall. But it's just an interesting, I just felt it was really well done. So I'm excited to continue the series.
Cool.
Hello.
You got another one.
I do have another one. I have a graphic memoir, Oh Brother, a graphic memoir by Georgina Chatterton. And this is children's, so I think it will really appeal to middle grade. Gina is, I'm going to say 8th, 9th grade, and she is moving into a new house, going to a new school. She's about to get a new best friend. But very quickly on the first few pages, you also meet Rob, who is her brother, who has autism. And who is autistic. What I really like is right away, she talks about the history of like usage of language and how we describe each other,
mm-hmm.
And how that's really changed and evolved and how it will continue to change and give lots of different, I guess, nuance to how we think of one another in mm-hmm. families and in our society. But she, it's one of these books that you've probably seen them all. There's a lot of books out there that are, speaking to that real slice of life experience in middle grade, early high school, and just the things that happen in the school setting. this book really, I think, centers in many ways about Rob and what it's like to grow up in a family where he, you know, needs a lot of different types of attention and is also someone who brings a lot of love and humor to the family. There are just so many scenes in the book that, you know, not only had me busting out laughing, but just made me think about, you know, how valuable it is to have a family who loves you deeply, who will do anything to accommodate you and help you get through life. And just the many changes that, you know, the family's had to do. They have these scenes where, you know, Rob is really interested in snacks. In fact, Gina is as well. And she has to hide her snacks. They come up with a very elaborate system of locks for the home to keep him from getting outside or doing something, like ending up on the garage, on the roof of the garage to get some sunbathing in, which actually happened. Just a really, really fun book. But also, I really like how Gina, her Georgina, she describes herself with pronouns she, they, as an awkward yet friendly Australian cartoonist with an undying love for eating snacks. She is actually involved in the publishing industry of comics. Her comics are really bright, really striking. I think that this book will, again, really appeal to children, but also to adults maybe who are interested in learning more about families. And the whole setting is in Australia, which for me, I love reading books about families set in other countries. Seeing what their school experience is like, what their homes look like, it's just really, really cool. So I hope you'll check it out. Oh Brother, a graphic memoir by Georgina Chatterton.
Funny that you mentioned Australia.
I know. My goodness. Well, somebody in this room has a little Australia obsession, and I've kind of stayed away from it for a while, haven't I? I haven't talked about as many Australian books.
It's
been a little chill, a little laid back. But on that giant TBR in the sky, I've had this book, Picnic at Hanging Rock by Joan Lindsay. And this is a 1967 book with a 1975 film of the same title.
I actually want to see the film, and I've noticed we have it.
We do. We have the movie, and it's highly acclaimed.
And it's also on Canopy now.
Oh, yes, it is. We have it on both formats, Blu-ray, DVD, and Canopy. And it was seen as a big thing in Australian cinema when it came out. It did something really good for Australian cinema. But let's get back to the book really quick. It is a... I would say, you know, I think about Jessica with these kinds of books because it's genre-less in a way. It is literary fiction for sure. But it's Australian Gothic, which we don't have a genre for that. But it's mystery. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit of horror.
Talked about doing it for my book discussion.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, there's almost like a slight fantasy element, but the horror kind of comes through, and of course the mystery. So what this is, it's 1900, it's turn of century, it's in an Australian town on the bush, and there's this really formal boarding school. It's like they took England, like they often did, and it, you know, dropped this very English boarding school right on the edge of the bush and was like, okay, we're English, but we're Australian, we're here. And so they're doing their thing, and they have this special picnic that they've scheduled on Valentine's Day, which is quite warm in Australia, and they take everybody out in their Victorian finery, and they're going to have this delightful little picnic at the base of this monolith, which is Macedon, which is actually a sacred rock going back, you know, a very long time, the Wurundjeri people. And they go and they're at the base of this and they're having their little picnic when four of the young women and then one teacher kind of follows, just go up and they're like, can we just go a little bit up this, you know, climb the little mountain a tiny bit? Oh, okay, you can go. So they go off again in their finery. They've got corsets and these long dresses and they go up the mountain and one young woman comes back and she's horrified. And the other people, include the other three young women and the teacher, are gone. They're absolutely gone. Now, one does get sort of found a little bit later in the book, but the others are never found. And then what follows is this sort of Australian Gothic kind of horror and mystery of the aftermath of a tragedy like this, you know, all of the fallout and how it affects the main school teacher, how it affects, you know, the families, how it affects the remaining girls. Mm-hmm. So it's that aftermath. And it is extremely tragic and kind of violent towards the end. It's lauded in Australian culture. It's an important book for them. And on the surface, it looks like what it does, and which is what I just said. But underneath, there are a lot of themes of colonialism, of the Aboriginal people and their understanding of the land and of the sort of Victorian and of the colonists' lack of understanding of the land, of fear of the land, including this monolith. So there are a lot of really interesting themes. This is a fun book to delve into afterward because you can learn a lot about the author and her intent and the kind of unusual way she let the story out and sort of made it seem like it might have been real. There is some mystery to that still because she did go to a boarding school and lived, you know, partially, you know, a little bit later than this book, but did go to a boarding school in that area herself. She was a spiritualist. So there's just a lot that after the book you can launch into, and of course watching the movie too. So okay. I'm glad I read it. It was, you know, it's hard to say, I love it with all my heart because it's just so dark.
Right.
But it's just an experience, and I couldn't put it down. Okay. So, yeah.
All right, I have the last two books, and I'm going to not spend a whole lot of time on them, but I do want to remind people that there is still, you know, that 250 reading challenge is still going on, and I'm still trying to work my way down. I still would actually like to complete. I'm doing actually pretty good. So one of the books I want to talk about briefly is Not Your Founding Father, How a Non-Binary Minister Became America's Most Radical Revolutionary by Nina Sekovich. It was just quirky enough that I was really, just really interested in kind of what in the world was going on, because this is nothing I've ever heard of. So in October of 1776, 23-year-old Jemima Wilkinson died, and the non-gendered religious leader, Public Universal Friend, began spreading the message of God. Okay, I'm hearing, I know this. Yes. Okay. So this is hard to talk about. So not only did the friend kind of distance themselves from Jemima Wilkinson, they also distanced themselves from pronouns in general. So you will find it's not they, it's not even they, them. It's they, the community referred to the friend as the friend. That's actually how Sankovic goes forward with the book, is that just uses the friend or the or Public Universal Friend in full. But it was a sect of Quakerism, and it was sort of an offshoot of Quakerism, very much but made more space for women. Supported abstinence, opposed slavery. If you're joining up, you were freeing your slaves. It had black members of the community. They are one of the first groups to sort of, quote unquote, head west for religious freedom. They were really pushing the boundaries of what does religious freedom mean in, you know, up against, you know, the revolution was going on when they were just getting started still. And when everything was settled and, you know, the country was really kind of getting itself set, they're kind of pushing the boundaries and sort of seeing, you know, what they can do and keep the community safe. It's really, the book is really kind of, it just kind of goes through, you get a background about the Wilkinson family and the community that they, in Vermont, where she started. And then you get more about the friend and the community that the friend built. And it's just, it's fascinating. It's fascinating to see the leaps that they made, the group made, but also sort of see the obvious ways that it could be undermined when people, it's sort of like colonialism, capitalism, every little thing that bothers us now is sort of eating into the community then. And it's just, it was really interesting. I'd never really looked at as much detail Quakerism and its various sects. They compare it to the Shakers, because they were kind of, Sienkiewicz sort of compares, people have looked at the Friends community as sort of more of a middle-class based group, whereas the Shakers were more of a, attracted more of a lower class participants. So it's just, it was just interesting to kind of look at that period. Also, the genealogist background in me, knowing that I have a line that goes to the same community. And if one is to believe the World Tree through Family Search, we are actually also related. So that was fascinating.
Oh, wow.
So it's just it was just an interesting thing to read. I totally never would have picked it up if not for the reading challenge. I've read more historical, more history and historical fiction this year than I normally would.
So
that's been interesting.
That one looked really, really interesting. Like, what is that about? You know, it's got a really compelling cover.
Yes, it does. Because there are a number of paintings of the Friend, and descriptions too, the Friend spent the rest of their life dressing androgynously, which got them, you know, you get the mixed responses. Rissus was positive. Some of the church fathers of the time, not so much.
Yeah.
I was really happy that I picked it up. It was really interesting. I hadn't really looked at that period, and it's kind of cool. The other one I want to say is just absolutely, I think maybe it's a love-or-hate type situation. I read Country People by Daniel Mason, which is the recent, last month's GMA pick, Good Morning America pick. It is quirky. It is just absurd. And it's a wonderful audiobook. It's one of those ones where Bill is multiple author, but it's sort of, they use a multiple voice, but they use the extra voices in very specific ways. So it's mostly read by one guy, and then there's some, you get like the radio show for this really tiny community around a university in Vermont. We're back to Vermont. So it's a West Coast family moving to Vermont for a year so the wife can take a visiting professor position. And theoretically, so the father can possibly maybe finish the dissertation he's been working on for, I don't know, 12, 15 years, forever. And they're hoping, you know, she's hoping maybe he will spend some time on that. But there's no end to distraction in this new community. They've never lived in any place tiny like this. They don't know what they're getting into. They are theoretically renting a house, or a house sitting for a professor, who's away, and they're not paying anything. And at various points, people are like, did you ever think to question why he didn't ask for money? and so there's something to the house that's not quite great. It's the couple and their two children. One's their son, the older child, is brilliant and probably could topple conspiracies all over the place if he was given the chance. And the daughter is a brilliant artist, but at that sort of age where, you know, girls can be mean and she's been picked on and gets picked on in school and stuff like that. It's just all sorts of things happening in this year and the life of this family as they try to settle into this very strange community, or they're strange and are shedding into a strange community. I laughed out loud. I had a few moments of total cringe as Miles' husband inevitably did something I would not have done, and just enjoyed the very strange journeys he has. He studies lore and literature. His dissertation is wandering. The topic is always wandering, but he's very into storytelling and that sort of thing. And so he sort of attracts kind of people that are like that, and it's a very, like, into the point that they find a community, he finds a community of people who are very convinced that there are entrances to a hollow earth in this Vermont area, and I have been looking for them. So
that's what I'm talking about.
It's absurd. It's wonderful. It's a fun audiobook, and one of the things it has almost oh my God, Minnesota Public Radio.
Like Garrison Keillor?
Yeah, okay. And it almost has that. There's radio portions to it where it's that sort of very local color. We're going to talk about pools today, or we're going to talk about that's, you know, the different radio shows. But those are the parts that actually come in with multiple voices where you've got people kind of calling in for a radio show.
Oh,
and sort of, and it's very, very weird and very local and very interesting and absolutely absurd. And I think it's either a love or hate type thing, but I really found it funny. I just took it as totally absurdist and satirizing people moving to the country, people who are academics, people who are small town. I mean, it, just a little bit of everybody, but I loved it.
Awesome. Wow. Sounds super zany.
It was definitely that.
Wow. That's the title you're seeing everywhere this year,
yep.
for sure.
Yep. Yeah. So just another one to check
out.
All right. All right.
Very cool.
So
happy end of summer reading.
Dump of titles.
Happy reading.
Yeah, everybody happy reading.